Indeed, indeed, with our special guest tonight, Dr. Michael Sala. And now we will take your phone calls right here on Coast to Coast AM. And Michael, what are you working on in the future? What's next for you?
Well, I'm just working more on this question of the celestials and their relationship with extraterrestrials. I think that there is a lot of issues surrounding the responsible use of technology, and that we need to be able to kind of balance that technological development with the kind of ethical evolution as a species. And so that's something that I'm personally and more committed to, and so that'll be what I'll be working on for the next year or two.
Some of the people in the field that you admire, who would they be?
Well, I do admire those that have been working in this field of exopolitics, looking at the political implications of ET life. The person who I think has probably done most work in this area, people like Stephen Greer, Steve Bassett has also done quite a lot in that. And others like Wendell Stevens, who's kind of one of my unsung heroes because of the early work he did in just making available a lot of the contactee stories. And he's certainly probably one of the most experienced UFO researchers in the world.
You know, what I like about the field too, Michael, is the specialists that are there in certain areas. You know, those who deal with abductions, those who deal, like you do, with exopolitics, Stanton Friedman, who has this broader approach. I mean, everybody brings to the table some area of their own expertise, and I think that's important.
It sure is. It's kind of like a university department in a way, informally, where you have one department that might be dedicated to a particular discipline, you know, whether it's political science or sociology. But within that, you have all these different fields, and people kind of specialize in those fields. But overall, they're kind of working within this rubric of a particular discipline. And so for all of us involved in exopolitics or UFO research, we have a very shared interest in the UFO ET question, but we have very different approaches and emphases and skills.
All right, to the phones we go now. Let's go to Jim in Maine. Questions or stories? Go ahead, Jim. You're on with us.
Hey, welcome back there, George.
Thanks, Jim.
Give you a toot on the old truck. Should load. Hey, I'm just curious. I've heard stories about these ETs that actually eat the flesh of livestock, and I believe that they possibly could be demonic entities that are actually just trying to keep us off the main track of why we're here. I think they could be demonic angels, one of the third that fell from heaven. What do you think about that?
I think we need to keep a couple of things in mind here. Is that there are those that do put out information about ETs that tries to skew it in a particular direction that basically raises the fear factor. Because if you put people in a place of fear, they're easy to manipulate. You know, when you're frightened of anything, certain brain areas are stimulated, and they tend to predominate over kind of more advanced or higher functioning brain areas. So if you make people fearful about the ET issue, that means then they're going to be looking at kind of like more simplistic solutions to it. Now, that's not saying that these things don't happen, because I think in many ways ETs are like us. You know, you have the whole spectrum of those that are really incredibly ethical and benevolent, and those that come at the other end who are really self-serving and kind of predatory. And so I think we have the whole range, and we just need to be discerning. But, you know, I think at the end of the day, just like any society, you're going to have your, you know, most are going to be kind of law-abiding, ethical people, beings, and you're going to have a kind of criminal class. And I think ETs are probably the same. You have a small criminal class, but I think that they're pretty much kind of controlled or monitored by the broader segment. So I hope that kind of answers your question.
Michael, you've talked a little bit about the movie Avatar and how that somehow ties into some of the things that we've been talking about tonight. Explain that.
Well, I think it's a very important movie. I think it works on a number of levels. You know, obviously there are the archetypal levels that James Cameron is kind of like using in the movie in terms of being able to kind of step into, you know, into a more evolved state of being where, you know, we are functioning at a higher level. On the other hand, I think there are some very important political messages kind of embedded in there. I thought it was really interesting the way he described or set up the whole kind of the movie in terms of corporations being in charge, that when it came to colonization of space, it wasn't governments that were in charge, it was corporations, and that these corporations were really kind of like unscrupulous entities that were, you know, really trying to maximize the dollar when they were going out there colonizing space. And I think there's a really important political message kind of embedded in there. I don't know if Cameron was aware of it consciously or whether just unconsciously he realized that in fact that is very much the problem that we have, that we are pretty much on the verge of secretly becoming, if we don't become aware and familiar with the issues, that we will very shortly become, if we haven't already, a colonizing space power that is dominated by corporations, and that the majority of humanity and our legislative political bodies won't have any influence over it at all. It'll just be these corporations that have these contracts to kind of mine a certain planet or take over a certain population, and I think that would be really horrible. And the Avatar movie, I think, is waking us up to that kind of possibility.
I find it to be very poetic that Cameron was one of the first to go to BP with some recommendations and suggestions on how to seal up this oil spill.
Very interesting.
Yeah. Let's go to Denver now in Colorado. Rose is there, west of the Rockies. Hey, Rose, good morning.
Hi, George. I want to thank you. I've emailed you and asked you to pray for me, and I appreciate that.
Absolutely.
I appreciate what you do. I have systemic lupus, and I'm an abductee, and the aliens that abduct me are the grays and the mantis beings. They're not nice at all.
How long has this been going on, Rose?
Since I was about 3 years old. They are very nasty to me. Dr. Jacobs and Bud Hopkins have helped me a great deal. I got to the point where I was going to put a 45 to my head, and they helped me. And I want to ask Dr. Sala, why don't the other beings intervene when people are victimized to the point that I am? I'm ill and they still abduct me. I am 61 years old and they're still abducting me.
Well, I'm really sorry to hear, Rose, about your situation. Why others don't step in? I think there's a kind of basic law of non-intervention. And when we look at the kind of political environment whereby certain agreements have been made between government corporate entities and certain extraterrestrial races, and that some of these agreements have sanctioned abductions, and even though certain limits and conditions were put in place, I think nevertheless, in principle, what we have is that there has been a certain degree of government complicity or sanctioning of that phenomenon, and which means that these beings that do this can say to anyone else wanting to intervene, you know, we're talking about a kind of more highly evolved ethical being wanting to intervene, that that they have no right, that in fact government has given them authority to intervene and work with citizens, private individuals in that way. That doesn't quite help you, just knowing that. What I would recommend is to maybe kind of look at ways to try and raise your own consciousness or build up certain skills so that you can deal with these beings in a way where you feel empowered rather than disempowered all the time. It's not an easy thing to do, but if you send me an email, I can maybe go into more detail into some of the things you might be able to do.
Okay, thanks, Rose. Good luck to you. Let's go to Floyd in Mississippi, Gulf Coast area. Go ahead there, Floyd.
Hello, George and Michael. Thank you. I'm a first-time caller from the Mississippi Gulf Coast, home of the BP disaster.
Yeah, absolutely. But,
I have a question here. I've really been listening to this conversation. I've been waiting for it all night. One of the things that I see a lot of, even the ancient aliens, by the way, George, you were great in that.
Oh, thank you.
There's a lot of talk about what's going on the moon. And my question is there any evidence that there's been ruins found or that any of the governments on this planet have a base there and are doing anything there?
Well, there is the work of those that have been photographing the moon or using satellite images of the moon, that there has been a number of books put out concerning structures on the moon. A lot of the kind of early Viking satellite images, some of the Apollo images of the moon, that some of these have very anomalous structures up there. And so there has been a kind of real cottage industry built up around that. Glenn Steckling wrote a book about bases on the moon. Another person by the name of George Leonard, if I'm correct, he also wrote about it. And he was one of the people that actually his work helped substantiate what Ingo Swann was recruited to do. Ingo mm-hmm. Swann was the remote viewer, and he was asked to basically see what he could find on the moon, and he found certain structures up there and certain beings up there that he assumed were extraterrestrials. And then in terms of validation, he was sent a book by this Leonard gentleman, and that the book kind of had structures and diagrams in there that validated what Ingo Swann was seeing kind of through remote viewing mechanisms. So that was also corroboration that there was stuff happening up there. And of course, Richard Hoagland, as I'm sure you're very familiar with, George, has spoken at length about what's up there on the moon.
Absolutely. Was that to Leonard Stringfield, by the way, who sent that on to Ingo?
No, it wasn't Leonard Stringfield. I thought it was a Leonard, but I can't remember the full name. But certainly, if you read Ingo Swann's account of what happened with Axelrod, James Axelrod, as I recall, in terms of having to remote view the moon, he'll mention that Axelrod said sent him a book, and this book validated what he had seen up there. It wasn't Steckling's book. It was another gentleman.
And Stringfield, of course, died in 1994. What a great researcher he was, Michael.
Well, that's right. He was before my time, actually. I really only got involved in this field in 2001. So I never got to meet with him or talk to him, as well as I never got to meet with or talk with John Mack. I would have loved to have done that.
How about Hynek? I assume you didn't meet him, did you?
No, I didn't meet him. Okay. But my colleague, Paula Harris, has told me all about these people. So she's met them, and so she kind of... So I work closely with Paula. She's probably listening, and I say hi to Paula. She's a very close colleague.
Let's elaborate just a little bit more on what you were talking about, the astrobiology conferences held by the Vatican and the Royal Society of London. Something's going on there, Michael.
Well, that's right. There's been a real shift here. In 2009, what we had was just a remarkable degree of openness by government entities and scientific bodies on the ET or UFO issue. And the Vatican really played a prominent role in that. I mean, the Vatican was, through its chief astronomer, was allowing these statements to be published on its on the Vatican's newspaper, official newspaper, L'Osservatore, that's published in Rome. And here you had Gabriel Furness, the astronomer, basically making all of these statements about extraterrestrials being our brothers, and that there was nothing incompatible in terms of belief in extraterrestrials with the Christian faith, and really kind of setting out the basis for how the Catholic world can really embrace the ET issue. And then the Vatican sponsored this conference in November of last year. Funes was the chief organizer, but the Vatican sponsored it, so it put up money. So this is, you know, a serious thing, and the Vatican was flying over some of the world's leading astrobiologists and thinkers on this field of astrobiology, and they had a really productive conference and issued a report. And then after that, you had probably one of the world's most prestigious scientific bodies, the Royal Society of London, mm-hmm. having its own conference in January, dealing again with extraterrestrial life and its implications. And I think what we're seeing here is a real opening up of the scientific community to the question of extraterrestrial life. And, you know, and I think what is really going to be a big shot in the arm for kind of scientific interest is as more of these exoplanets are discovered that are kind of Earth size, that's going to revolutionize thinking.
Okay, let's go to our Skype caller. Michael is in Normandy, France. There you go. Go ahead, Michael. Good morning.
Good morning, George and Michael. Yes, I'd like to relay an incident I had. I was a security specialist on Pease Air Force Base. We worked with our aircraft that was nuclear loaded, and they would go to Russia at any time, alert aircraft. And in October of 1975, I was just getting ready to get out, and we had an alert status go off, except it wasn't a full exercise, and our pilots had jumped in their planes, and they took off to Russia. And what I found out a little while after that was that the screen showed incoming Russian missiles. Well, the pilots got about a quarter of the way to Russia and came back. The next day, they got halfway to Russia. And this was right after an incident, about 2 weeks after an incident on the base, where we had a very large green glowing object land at the end of the runway. And the area supervisor went out there, the thing shot off, and our radar from our base in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, all the way to Logan Airport in Boston went snowy that night after this ship took off. 1975 on that base was very interesting. We had all kinds of sightings over the base, and in that time frame, I guess a lot of other bases did too. I don't know if anyone's heard about that or not, but I'd be curious if Michael had heard anything about that time period. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. And I guess sometimes we're a little bit more than coast to coast. We're planet to planet. Go ahead, Mike.
Yes. Well, one day you might take an off-planet call. You never know.
Well, that's right. We'll have an ET call on our Skype line.
Yes, well, that's a really interesting story about Pierce Air Force Base and the planes being scrambled, and you have these incoming missiles that actually turned out to be UFOs. That reminded me of what Robert Dean talked about in terms of when he was stationed at NATO's headquarters in Paris in 1963, that in fact a high-level study was commissioned because that kind of phenomenon was happening, that there was what appeared to be missiles kind of coming from east to west, you know, coming from the Warsaw Pact into NATO countries, and that, as it turned out, that they were UFOs. And so they basically began to do a high-level study to find out, well, what's going on with this? Because obviously if we confuse these UFOs with a nuclear missile attack, then, you know, we could have an accidental nuclear war. And so it seems as though something similar to that was happening at Pierce Air Force Base, and that wouldn't surprise me at all.
Yeah, those things almost happen too, Michael. Stay with us. We'll be back in a moment. We'll take final phone calls. I'm George Norrie, and this is Coast to Coast AM. And our next Coast to Coast program, we're going to talk about living off the grid. Fascinating story. And on Wednesday, Christian Von Laer joins us as we talk about some 2012 prophecies, followed by special reporter Linda Moulton Howe on our Thursday show. And then we're back to open lines and some special scary stuff on Friday. We'll be back in a moment with Final Calls, though, with Dr. Michael Sala and you on Coast to Coast AM. Michael, in your career, what has been for you the most fascinating extraterrestrial UFO story you've ever heard?
Well, I am most impressed with the kind of early contactee reports. I mean, those are the most incredible, where people would be just picked up and you know, met and picked up and taken to a location. And some of those early stories that Adamski talked about, where he was met at hotels and then driven to remote locations, taking up on a vehicle, on a space vehicle, and then held all these incredible experiences. Those are pretty amazing.
Yeah, they sure are. Let's go to final calls now. We'll pick it up by going to Woonsocket, Rhode Island. Richard, east of the Rockies. Hey, Richard, good morning.
Hello. Forgive the hum, Mr. Norrie.
Ah, got it. Okay.
Okay. You know, I've been briefed on your site, Dr. Sala. I just want to exalt those who are very, very dedicated in elder wiseness. And I'll mention three names, including Dr. Edgar Mitchell. And the thing is, the first name was Raymond Fowler. I'm sure you guys are familiar with him. He's a Bible scholar, master's in Christian Bible theology and Eastern religions, and he's from the National Security Agency. And he's been into this stuff for about 56 years. The other fellow was Dr. Don Elkins, who's a fighter pilot, airline pilot, got a PhD in mechanical engineering and physics. So they emphasize the nuts and bolts background, you know, and they've been into this for about 48, 58 years. And the third one was Ed Mitchell's buddy, Jack Bentoff. Barbara McLeod had mentioned one time, and Callers will mention it mercurially, his book, Stalking the Wild Pendulum on the Mechanics of Consciousness. You know, he talks about hyperdimensional energy, meditation, the creator, and how all the system of, you know, spirituality and physics works. But with Dr. Don Elkins, he came out with the fact that he was best friends with Dr. J. Allen Hynek. And one of the guests and a caller, I mentioned the Law of One, I think it's from the humble messenger named Ra. Now, it sounds funny. It's, channelers, you know, here we go again. But when I went over this particular material, he had a subject by the name of Carla Rucker, born-again Christian, and had a master's in library science, an English major. And George McCarty had about the same credentials. And Dr. Elkins spent a lot of time with that, as well as his factual research. And when I got into Dr. Lazaret, the karate expert, his stuff, he's a psychologist, right, and metaphysics, he's top-notch in defense. I went back to him, and he recommended Brotherhood of the White Temple College, because he's a graduate, as well as work with the cops, commandos, and everything, kids, you know, you name it. And when I went over there, material, it was the same schemata, fellas, as what Raymond Moody was talking about. And what Raymond Fowler was saying was that Bud Hopkins and Charles Haynes seemed to miss what Dr. Sala is delineating here, is that there's a spiritual, theological element to this, and that it's hyperdimensional. And you know, Michael Cremo made a wonderful, wonderful comment last week. He says, we've been 500 or 600 years behind the times. And Uncle George has been nagging us about this for a long time, to tune in and do the meditation and everything, you know, and you start getting into stuff like this and it piles up, you know.
Well, there's no doubt. What do you think of this consciousness aspect of this, Michael?
Well, as I said before, it really is an important topic. And thank you, Richard, for bringing up Don Elkin and Carla Rucker. We actually had Carla Rucker and Jim McCarthy come out to Hawaii and participate in our annual Earth Transformation Conference. I know George has it linked up there on the website.
Yeah.
So we have these speakers come in every year, and we had Carla Rucker there, and she talked about the Ra material and the consciousness raising effect, and she actually mentioned the congruity with the material that I had been putting out in terms of U.S. government policy and so forth, and she very kindly gifted me with a kind of fifth book. That there's four books that make up the Ra material, but there was a fifth book that was kind of like not really prominently put out there, but she gave me that, and just commenting on the similarity in terms of the things that I've been saying and what she's saying. And I just wanted to say finally, because I know there's not much time left, the Ra material really was one of the pioneering works in terms of emphasizing the importance of consciousness raising, and it talked about this kind of the harvest and this period in humanity's history where basically if people's consciousness has reached a certain point, then we're ready to evolve from one kind of density plane into another. But the really interesting thing about it was that back in 1983, way before anyone was talking about it, they mentioned that this would happen around 2011, that this harvest would happen then. That was the period. And so, you know, this was well before people began talking about 2012 and the whole kind of end of the Mayan calendar. So, you know, that period in terms of it being a critical point in our evolution as a species from one density into another density, more refined density where we have a higher consciousness and are able to do more things, it was really the raw material that was the first to put that out.
You know, Michael, I was thinking about some of the Hollywood movies of UFOs and ET visitations that have been done to either educate us or to let us know what was going on. And it's amazing, like the original black and white Day the Earth Stood Still, one of the classics. And then we got into Close Encounters of the Third Kind with Richard Dreyfuss, ET the Extraterrestrial, and a couple more of my favorites, The Abyss and Contact. But they all have certain messages behind them. Have you noticed that?
I think that they're kind of almost like messages that wake people up. I mean, I do think that there's a... I don't think it's just movies either. I think it's crop circles, that these critical movies, that they have an effect of kind of activating people. It's like, I know myself, it's just like in 2001, I was woken up. I mean, it was like someone turned on the light and I could not go back to what I was doing. The thought of teaching international politics at a university, even though it was a really prestigious career in many ways, it just seemed so dull compared to what I had been turned on to, and I just couldn't do it, and no matter how hard I tried. And I remember sitting in front of kind of all these job applications that I could have applied for or these jobs, and I couldn't do it. And it's because there was a switch that was turned on. And for me, it was that Disclosure Project press conference. For someone else, it might be, you know, watching the Day the Earth Stood Still or a crop circle. I think, you know, within us, we have all of these kind of mysteries and all of these kind of hidden parts of who we are. And once it's activated, we can't go back.
No, we can't. Let's go to Jen in Ohio. Hey, Jen, go ahead. You're up with us.
Yes, hello. I had two comments.
Sure.
One is when disclosure does happen, and I think it might, I don't think the government's ever going to come out and disclose. I think it's going to be forced by ships showing up in the sky kind of thing. But I think the most shocking thing for some people is that some of the beings visiting us are human. And I mentioned Close Encounters of the Third Kind. I think in a way, if you remember in that movie, he started, just not him, but there are people all over the world that started having dreams and visions of Devil's Tower or whatever. And it was like on some telepathic channel, you know, the contact was being made to individuals all over the planet. And I think that's occurring now too.
Well, thanks for bringing that up, Jen, because that's something that's overlooked a lot, that there are so many stories about greys and reptilians and abductions and so forth that people overlook that really the field began with many stories, many positive, uplifting stories about contact with these human-looking extraterrestrials. And, you know, many of the early contactees from the 50s, 60s, and even early 70s all talked about human-looking extraterrestrials that were often just very attractive beings, and you know, it was enormous public interest in it, and I believe some of the conferences that George Van Tassel organized there at Giant Rock, I mean, they had about 11,000 people going to these conferences, to these conventions, and just incredible public interest, but I think that in a way, you hit the nail on the head when you said that this was very dangerous. It was dangerous to the government because government didn't want the public to know that there were these really beautiful-looking, human-looking extraterrestrials out there meeting people and introducing them to philosophy and advanced technology and spirituality. They didn't want that to happen. They wanted to introduce the fear factor, and the fear factor was the gray extraterrestrials, and they've been very successful in that.
Okay, great. Couple more callers to go. Mac in New Orleans and Louisiana. Go ahead, Mac. Hi.
Hey, how y'all doing this morning, guys?
Good.
Hey, I'd like to mention, George, one thing real quick. I got a question for Michael, but I'd like to mention that Coast to Coast is a great diversion for everything that's been going on down here with the with BP, you know, BP oil spill,
yeah.
and then before even back to Katrina. So the show's great. I'd like to ask Michael a question on implants. First, what percentage of abductees would you say or have implants? And I have a comment on implants, too. Wouldn't it make sense? I've seen several documentaries where they take the implant and they take a look at it and they say, well, it's just normal material. Well, wouldn't that make sense that if the ETs want to be as elusive as they can, that they wouldn't use anything from Zeta Reticuli, that use something from here?
Well, in terms of how many implants are out there, I think you probably would begin by an estimate of how many abductees there are out there. And I believe it was Alan Hynek and David Jacobs and Bud Hopkins. I think they organized some survey, and I think they came up with a figure of several million were abductees. And I would say probably the majority of those would probably have these kind of these tracking devices in them, and the kind of implants. What they're made out of, I guess they are made out of some advanced technology with some kind of biological material so that the body doesn't reject it. And they've been doing that for a number of years, and I'm sure they're expert enough to be able to miniaturize them enough so that very few people can spot them.
Okay, let's go to Endicott, New York. Guy's turn on Coast to Coast. Good morning, Guy.
Hi, George. How are you? You and Art Bell are the best of the best of the best. I've been wanting to tell you this story for a long time. In April of 08, around the 15th or the 16th, I'm not sure exactly what day it was, my wife was living right outside of White Plains, New York, near Walkabuck, New York. And it was around 8 o'clock in the evening. And my wife said to me, she's going to take a walk outside. I said, okay, go. About 5 or 6 minutes later, I decided to walk outside after her. And I just happened to take a look up in the sky. And I saw a black object, a quiet black object, triangular. Well, actually, it wasn't triangular. It was like home plate, all right, in a baseball.
Yeah.
And it was unbelievable, and it lasted for about maybe 15 or 16 seconds. And I looked at my wife, and I said to her, I said, you just saw a UFO. It was there, and it just disappeared.
How big was it, Guy?
It was huge.
Yeah.
And I called Westchester Airport, and, of course, you know, they said, there's no such sighting. We didn't see anything or anything like that. But, you know, I've always believed in this. And to see it firsthand is really something else. And I have wanted to call you and tell you that, because I never saw it like I saw it.
And with it being so silent, that must have been eerie, Guy.
Very eerie. And something else, George, it was a beautiful, beautiful evening. The sky was purple. It was around 8:15 in the spring. And this black object just stood right out.
Michael, we've heard a lot of reports about this object.
It reminds me of the Cash Landrum case. I remember it was a kind of diamond-shaped UFO, very big, that was being kind of tracked, and that it resulted in some people being badly burned. I mean, I don't know, in this case, Guy didn't kind of have any negative effect, but it seems that there are these UFOs that are diamond-shaped. I guess that kind of fits the description that that guy gave. And, I mean, they're huge. One thing he did say that the radar didn't pick it up. I know in doing some of the research on the way in which the FAA kind of monitors air traffic is that the modern radar in the United States, and you may know this, George, is that it's designed in a way where anything larger than, say, you know, two times a jumbo jet is automatically registered as a cloud, and therefore the radar will not show it. So you could have a kind of mile-wide UFO that's picked up on radar, but the radar will register it as a cloud, and it won't appear on the UFO. It won't appear on the radar. So that's why often you do have FAA kind of commenting, oh, well, no, we didn't see anything, even though it was a huge UFO. It's because the equipment is designed to kind of factor that out, such large objects.
Do you think that we got more solid UFO cases back in the 50s than we do now?
Well, I think in the 40s and the 50s, the big difference was that many military sources were allowed to come forward. Many pilots were able to report what had happened. Radar evidence was released. In fact, Donald Kehoe, back in the early 1950s, was given access to some of these UFO reports by the Air Force, and he actually published it in one of his early books. And so it was kind of unprecedented, and it's never been repeated. In 1954 was when they passed the JNAP regulation, Joint Army-Navy Air Publication 164, I believe, and that basically made it illegal for military pilots or anyone in the civilian airline industry to report to the general public any UFO that was being covered under that JNAP protocol, and so that's when everything went quiet. But those early reports are the best, and I don't think anything that has happened since then comes close to those early reports, which really proved, to my mind, the reality of this issue being extraterrestrial in nature. And Donald Kehoe was the first to kind of like really emphasize that the evidence was overwhelming, that we are being visited by extraterrestrials, and that was back in the 50s.
Let's get one more quick question. And Joshua in Lafayette, Louisiana, only have about a minute left. Josh, go ahead.
George, glad to talk to you, man. Listen to you every chance I get.
Thank you.
Make it quick. Ever since then, the oil spills happened, I've seen double the amount of chemtrails down here. I mean, it's just like spiderwebs certain evenings. I mean, they're just all over the place. And then almost, you can set your clock by it almost about 2 hours after you start noticing them, which is late in the evening, you'll start seeing, by the time it starts getting dark, all kinds of lights. I mean, I'm talking lights. Now, these things are moving twice the speed of what your fighter jets move. I mean, and we don't really have a Air Force base real close other than Barksdale or Fort Polk. Any ideas why there might be more chemtrails now that the oil spill?
That's interesting. 30 seconds, Michael, go ahead.
Well, I mean, I think with the chemtrails, it may have something to do with the fact that it allows the atmosphere to conduct certain electromagnetic energies that might be part of some kind of pulse-generated electromagnetic wave that could be used against extraterrestrials.
Well, we know one thing, Michael. We know they are everywhere. Michael, thanks so much for being on the program. Again, another stellar job by you. For Dan Galante, Jason King, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasur, Stephanie Smith, Ross Mitchell, George Knapp, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe.